Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
This plane is insanely maneuverable. Yeah. This is sort of a Dutch equivalent of the Japanese Zero. It may not be fast, but it can outturn anything in the air against it, particularly these all-metal, inline-engine racing fighters that Germany and Britain are now fielding, like the Spitfire and the ME-109. They make the mistake of getting into turning fights with this aircraft.
Yeah.
You're going to lose.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Ryan Noppen. Ryan is a military author with a Master's of Arts degree in European History, and is the author of Holland 1940, The Luftwaffe's First Setback in the West. Holland possessed Europe's first fully integrated anti-aircraft network, as well as modern and competitive aircraft. On May 10, 1940, the German attack was only partly successful, and the Dutch fought on for another 4 days. On the fifth day, with its original strategy having largely failed, the Luftwaffe resorted to terror bombing Rotterdam to force a surrender. Ryan, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Ryan, fascinating story. Really enjoyed the book. But before we get on to that, can you tell us how your aviation heritage came about and what your background in aviation is?
Well, I came to fall in love with aviation as a child, just reading books originally as a child. The works of Richard Scarry, which I now enjoy with my two very young children, but also under the tutelage of a great uncle of mine, Orst Opdholt, who was himself a child of Dutch immigrants. He was a P-61 pilot over Japan for the last months of World War II. And he just really fostered a love in aviation. He was a rally racing driver. He got me into cars, model railways. He was a big kid who really encouraged the love of things that were fast. And as I went on into university studies, undergraduate and graduate, I went into the field of history and was really encouraged by two advisors to pursue an interest in aviation at that time. The first was Dr. Michael Smith at Purdue University in the state of Indiana. He was a Soviet space historian who said, "You have a lot of good interest in aviation. This is something that you should pursue your research in." But then most importantly, I fell under the wing of a very prominent British aviation historian, the late R.E.G. Davies, who was probably one of the most prolific commercial aviation authors of the 20th century. D-Day veteran, a designer for the de Havilland Company, had his hand in the design of the de Havilland Comet, and then later became the curator of air transport at the National Air and Space Museum. He took me under his wing, really fostered my love of aviation, showed me areas where I could do research, particularly with KLM, the Royal Dutch Airlines, and really was a merciless stickler in perfecting writing in the English language for particularly a UK audience, getting rid of all my American idiosyncrasies and whatnot. But I still thank him to this day for that.
And Ryan, did you ever think about covering your grandfather's exploits over Japan?
Well, that may come at some point, yes. But where the genesis of this project got started comes from my own upbringing, so to speak. I come from a Dutch family. My grandparents were emigres to this country, my grandfather coming just before the First World War. And so I grew up in this little pocket of Western Michigan where we attended Dutch Reformed Church. I went to private Dutch schools. So I was part of this last generation of this very inclusive European communities that you used to have in this country. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with stories from great aunts and uncles who still live in the Netherlands, who survived the bombing of Rotterdam. They watched the bombing from the roofs of their houses. And so we grew up with all sorts of stories of the Dutch occupation. You know, most people, you know, they know of Anne Frank and perhaps Corrie ten Boom. But, you know, at my school, when it was Grandparents' Day, just about every other, student colleague of mine would bring their grandpa and they would tell their stories of the occupation and how they were doing things against the Germans. So this was sort of in my blood. I went to a small college in Michigan called Calvin College, which was a Dutch Reformed school. And there I actually went on to work there for a while as a researcher. And I became close friends with the retired president of the college, a gentleman by the name of William Spoolhoff. Well, one day over coffee, he came to tell me a bit of his unique background. Well, it turned out before being a college professor and a president, during World War II, he was an OSS operative, an agent. Wow. And was actually a personal aide to Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands during his tenure abroad. And he also shared with me that he was actually a good friend of my grandfather's in his youth. And I had shared with him some of these stories about aviation that I liked. And he said, "This will make a good book." So the next time we had coffee, he told me, "What are you doing Friday for lunch?" And I said, "Eating." And he goes, "No, you're going over to this restaurant and you're meeting with a publisher friend of mine because I told him about your ideas and now you're going to write a book about Dutch aviation." So, okay. And the culmination of all that process was my first large book, which was called Blue Skies, Orange Wings, The Global Reach of Dutch Aviation in War and Peace. And I did this as a comprehensive history of Dutch aviation, commercial and military, for the first decades of the 20th century. And it was in that book and doing the research of that, you know, with several trips to Holland, researching at what was then the Dutch Air Force Museum in Soesterberg, and then also the Dutch military archives in Den Haag, I began to put together overview of these 5 days of Dutch aerial resistance against the Germans.
Wow, Ryan, that's quite an amazing story. I sort of feel bonded to you through my heritage. But let's go back to put some context around 1940 and events leading up to the air battle that we're going to discuss shortly.
Okay. So we get to the years coming up to World War II. What is the state of the Netherlands? The Netherlands has some interesting diplomatic history during this period. Traditionally, the long-term rival of Holland, going back to the Golden Age, were the British, because there were three Anglo-Dutch wars, which the British and the Dutch fought for control of the world seas. And the last two actually saw the Dutch being victorious, but eventually, in the 18th century, Britain eventually comes to dominate through numbers, and the Dutch begin to back away, content to reap the harvest of a vast trade and colonial empire. The Dutch become allies of the British during the Napoleonic Wars. So the alliances shift again, but then we see a shift in alliances toward the end of the 19th century, and this is due to the Boer War in South Africa. The idea of the British putting Dutch Boer women and children into concentration camps throughout the war did not sit well with the Dutch population. And with Germany now at this time becoming Holland's primary trading partner, majority Dutch sympathy actually begins to drift toward Germany. And during World War I, although Holland is neutral, there's a slight majority of the Dutch population and Dutch leadership that would not necessarily be unhappy if Germany had won that war as a result. Because partially of feelings to the war, but also there is a sort of a underling feeling toward the British. By this time, the Dutch colonial empire exists in some Dutch politicians' mind is because the British allow it. The Dutch are no longer a dominant sea power. If the Dutch were to take an active stance against Britain, they would immediately lose the Dutch East Indies, other territories like that. So while there is sympathy for Germany, there is enough good sense not to provoke the English. This is where we get at the end of the First World War. And this is sort of the still going on feeling into the 1920s and the 1930s. There's some sympathy toward Germany, but again, smart neutrality play is do not upset the English because that will result in the loss of the colonial empire. But as Hitler comes to power and becomes much more militant, there is a concern about the defense of Dutch territory because Hitler obviously breaks all of his diplomatic treaties. He shows no compulsion. But it's an interesting play. The Dutch hope diplomacy will keep Germany neutral. And in fact, Germany is still Holland's primary weapons supplier on the eve of World War II. The Dutch are actually working on a new class of battle cruisers that are being designed in Germany based on the Scharnhorst class. This design work goes right on up until the date of the German invasion of the Netherlands. The Dutch are considering aircraft purchases. Most of the country's artillery purchases come from Germany. So that is where the state of Holland is. So I went into a little detail there, but when it comes to the defense of the Netherlands, there's always the traditional defense. And this is what is called the Waterlinie, the waterline. This is a series of canals that encircles the main area of Western Holland, the urban centers of Rotterdam, Amsterdam, Den Haag, and Utrecht. And for centuries, the idea was to flood the plains in the eastern part of the country, use the rivers and canals to defend the south, and no enemy is able to cross those water boundaries. In fact, there was this famous series of propaganda photos where the Dutch, after the First World War, purchased one Renault FT-17 tank. And there's all sorts of pictures of this poor tank being stuck in the mud in the water as it tried to breach the water line. So the Dutch were fairly confident that the water line would hold out the main urban areas. Technology changes, though. While tanks and troops may not be able to walk through water, aircraft can fly over water. And yeah. So in the 20s and the 30s, Dutch aerial strategists say, we need to beef up our aerial defenses. We need to beef up the air force. Attack can now come from the air. Our traditional water lines will not be able to solely protect us. And so this is where we get a gentleman by the name of Petrus Wilhelmus Best. He was a lieutenant colonel, and he was appointed the head of the Dutch Air Services, the LVA, the Luftfahrtafdeling, in 1933. And he's really the advocate who says, if we are going to defend ourselves in a coming world war or another European war, we have to defend our aerial borders. We have to protect our cities from aerial bombardment. And he spearheads the initiative to create what you've been referring to as really Western Europe's first integrated aerial defense network.
Ryan, that's a fascinating build-up, but of course there was also a build-up to the east, and the Dutch had to start looking east as well.
So the Dutch are not blind to this. The Dutch military actually has a very vibrant and very effective intelligence service, and this is called GS3, or Generalstaffsektie 3, and The Dutch have agents all throughout Germany. Typically, these are businessmen who are also part of this intelligence section. They're reporting on German buildups. KLM flights across Germany from Amsterdam. KLM is the third largest airline in the world at this time. Their pilots tend to be members of the intelligence section as well. So they happen to divert, you know, they get off course and they look at German troop buildups, German military exercises. All of this gets reported back to Den Haag. So they know something is amiss. So what Bess does to prepare for this is he says, we need to build up our fighter forces, and there's effort to do this. Now, the problem is, there is not a lot of money to go around. Holland was hit very badly by the Great Depression. Holland was one of the last countries in Western Europe to go off the gold standard. Holland was also one of the last countries in Western Europe to industrialize, because prior to that, its economic well-being had come from overseas trade and agricultural products. Yeah. So there is not a lot of money, but he does convince the Dutch government to invest in fighters. And in the years leading up to the war, he purchases a slew of anti-aircraft weapons, modern ones. So what we're talking about are Vickers 7.5 millimeter guns from England and the Czech Republic. He buys a mountain of Oerlikon 20 millimeter cannons and also 40 millimeter Bofors guns. These are all the best anti-aircraft guns in the world. That's all well and good, but it's his organization of how this goes. They're divided around the main airfields and urban centers in the Western Netherlands, but they are all connected by phone or radio to one central office in Den Haag. And that is what is called the Centraal Luchtvaartbureau. And what this office does is it disseminates all information coming from different observation posts all throughout the country, and it coordinates defensive operations and movements from one place. So every observation post has a direct phone line to the central office in Den Haag. This is something that is new. You know, you get to Belgium and France, their air defense networks, their observation posts don't have their own phones. They don't have their own radio signals. You know, you read stories in France that during the early weeks of the war, French observation posts and anti-aircraft batteries have to run to the nearest farmhouse or pub to communicate with central command because they didn't put the effort into good communications. Well, Bess does this. And so the wonderful thing being is, as soon as a German aircraft flies over Dutch territory, it's picked up by the first observation post, and then it's tracked by every subsequent observation post that reports then back to Den Haag. And that means anti-aircraft batteries can be coordinated for the defense of that. Necessary fighter squadrons can be scrambled in different sectors. And so this is what you have here is you have Europe, Western Europe's first integrated air defense network, because this one command post also commands all the searchlight companies. It commands anti-aircraft batteries. It's able to give the command of squadrons to scramble. And here's some other fun thing. You know, in the months leading up to, the German invasion of the Netherlands, the command post is conducting experiments with individual fighter aircraft by vectoring them against potential threats by radio. Minor problem is not every Dutch fighter has a radio in it at this point due to budget concerns. But again, this is forward thinking. Who does this several months down the road? The British. The British perfect that system during the Battle of Britain. And lastly, one little fun thing, the Dutch are experimenting with an early radar set that was developed by the Philips Corporation, the Philips Electronics Corporation, that can detect aircraft up to 18 kilometers out. This system is not in place by the time of the German invasion, but it is already being experimented with. So this, in a nutshell, is the integrated defense network that Bess created on the eve of the German attack.
Ryan, we did a feature on Fokker some time ago. Fascinating character. Can you talk us through the build-up and the aircraft capabilities that the Dutch had developed by 1940?
Absolutely. So the two I'm going to focus on are the two primary Dutch fighters that were involved in the Meidachen, the Dutch word for the Maydays, the German attack. The first is the Fokker D-21. This is a single-engine monoplane fighter, you know, at first glance. And there are two replicas in existence in the Netherlands. You can see, in fact, one is actually flying now. But you look at this plane.
Wow.
It looks a little anachronistic. It's got fixed landing gear. This plane was designed in 1936. It's got four machine guns, and it's of mixed construction, part metal, part welded steel frame covered with canvas or wood. This is the traditional Fokker construction technique. Fokker did not get into all metal production until in the late 30s. The reason being for this is Antony Fokker himself was very reluctant to invest money into research and design. Mixed construction worked well during the First World War. It worked well for his airliners in the 20s and the 30s. Why change? Why fix something if it's not broken?
Yeah.
Interesting story on that. Fokker does eventually adapt all metal construction, but this is after he purchases the license production rights for the Douglas DC-2 and DC-3 airliners from Donald Douglas in 1934. And what Fokker does with the first Douglas airliner that comes over, he has his engineers go over it from top to bottom and says, all right, figure out how to make all metal aircraft from this. So it's basically a light version of almost industrial espionage. But Fokker, being a good pecunious Dutchman, wanted to do his R&D on the cheap, and he did it. Douglas was not happy about this afterward, but it did create a generational leap for Fokker. But going back to this, the Fokker D-21.
Fascinated by this aircraft.
The mixed construction in this actually allows for a very lightweight aircraft, even though it has fixed landing gear and a radial engine of only 840 horsepower. This plane is insanely maneuverable.
Yeah.
This is sort of a Dutch equivalent of the Japanese Zero. It may not be fast, but it can outturn anything in the air against it, particularly these all-metal inline engine racing fighters that Germany and Britain are now fielding, like the Spitfire and the ME-109. And the problem that you're going to see in Holland that the Germans do not realize is they make the mistake of getting into turning fights with this aircraft, just like Americans early in the Pacific War get into turning fights with the Zero. You're going to lose. You're going to lose against the plane that has superior maneuverability. And that is the big benefit of the Fokker D-21 in this plane. I now want to move on to the second fighter, the Fokker G-1. This is a revolutionary design at the time. The Dutch refer to it as a Jagdcruiser or a fighter cruiser. But what this is this is almost like an early version of the P-38 Lightning. It's a twin boom, twin engine fighter. Again, not super powered. It has two 800 horsepower Bristol Mercury engines, but it's also of mixed construction, which makes it light, And really, its killer punch is it has eight machine guns in its nose. No other aircraft at this time has such an armament like that, does it? You know, the BF-110 has a nice mix of cannon and machine guns, but the punch of eight 7.9 millimeter Browning machine guns is pretty lethal. So you combine that with an aircraft that can, you know, actually the G-1 can outturn the ME-109. So, and if this happens to get on the tail of a fighter or a bomber, it only takes a short burst to cause critical damage in this. And this plane was revolutionary. The world was talking about it. It was exhibited at the Paris Air Salon in 1937, and everyone said, oh my gosh, we have to create planes like this. And it was intended that this plane would eventually be up-engined, but the war intervenes. But these two fighters, due to their maneuverability and particularly the superior firepower of the G-1, and although there are very few of these aircraft, there are only 36 of each aircraft in the Dutch inventory at this time. This gives the Dutch Air Force a particularly potent punch in the hands of good pilots, and their pilots are trained to capitalize on the unique advantages of these aircraft. One thing where I want to spend just a moment, because again, I think the listeners may not be aware of this, Best and the Dutch Air Force are already looking beyond these fighters before the war even begins. So these are the products of domestic Dutch industry. Best does not feel he can wait for Dutch domestic industry to catch up technologically to other foreign competitors. They do, but he also wants to look at other designs. Best is willing to purchase from abroad. He makes inquiries about buying Hawker Hurricanes to supplement these new Dutch aircraft coming into service. He makes inquiries about the Supermarine Spitfire. And most interestingly, and this is the one that the Dutch Air Force, I think, considered the most of foreign purchases, was a Daimler-Benz engine variant of the Heinkel 112 elliptical wing single engine fighter. Now, the performance of this aircraft actually bested that of the Spitfire Mark I. And this plane was pretty heavily tested at Soesterberg, but it was ultimately the cost that turned it down. But so the Dutch were considering competitive foreign designs, but also on the eve of the war, domestic industry was just getting into prototype development of two very radical fighter designs. This was the first of these was the Fokker D-23. This was a twin-engine pusher-puller twin-boom fighter design, which with competitive engines would have been faster than any fighter in existence. The only engines available for it at the time were Czech Walter Sagata, little 530 horsepower inline engines. But even with two of those, the plane still had a respectable top speed of 326 miles per hour. And the other one, which was a single engine twin boom fighter, and this was produced by the Dutch company called the Schelde, their S-21 fighter prototype was to have been powered by a single Daimler-Benz DB600 engine. Armed with four machine guns and a 20-millimeter cannon, this plane had a projected top speed of 370 miles per hour already in 1939. Yeah. And in addition to those, Fokker was already developing a twin-engine replacement for the G-1, and he also had an all-metal medium bomber, the T-9, in development as well. So there was a lot of...
Is that the one that looks a tiny bit like the Liberator? I see when I looked at it.
Not the Liberator, more of like a cross between the Martin B-10 and the B-25 bomber we've got. But it's actually, this plane had superior performance to the HE-111 and basically comparable performance to the Junkers JU-88. Mm-hmm. The point being here is there is a lot of rapid last-minute quantum leap in technological development going on in Holland on the eve of the war because of Best's work at this point.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
So the Dutch not only had some very capable aircraft, but they had some very capable pilots as well. Very small band, but very capable. Let's move over to the German element of the air battle and how that unfolds. And Hitler wasn't committed to this, really, was he? He wasn't convinced that invading Holland was the right thing.
Yeah, originally Hitler wanted to keep Holland neutral during the Second World War, similar to how Holland was neutral in the First World War. In some ways, you know, you could argue that Holland and also Sweden were perhaps shadow allies of Germany in the First World War because they allowed a lot of foreign trade to flow through their borders into Germany through the British blockade. And Hitler still wanted to have access to that sort of shadow trade route. But eventually it was Hermann Göring and his chief of staff, Hans Jeschenek, who told Hitler, no, Holland needs to be occupied. And Hitler says, why? And he goes, the British may actually move into Holland and commandeer Dutch air bases. What this would give the British the capability of doing is it would give them air bases within range of the Ruhr industrial area. British bombers at this time did not have very long legs. They needed to be closer to their targets, especially if there was to be any sort of fighter protection for them. Yeah. And Jeschenek in particular said, do not put it past the British to do this. They will attack the Ruhr. That is our most vulnerable weak point. You know, our air defenses are pretty minimal there at this point. The smart move is to include Holland in the general planning for Fall Gelb, the invasion of the West.
Yeah.
And Hitler at first balks. He says, no, I don't think this is a good idea. And then, so the planning for Fall Gelb goes on. In mid-January, the initial plans for Fall Gelb fell into Allied hands. A German liaison aircraft accidentally landed in Belgium. And in one of the officers' briefcases were some of the preliminary plans for Fall Gelb. German high command goes into panic at this point. We need to revise all of our plans, And as part of this plan revision, Göring and Jeschenek have been badgering Hitler. You have to include Holland. You have to include Holland. You have to include Holland. Hitler finally agrees on January 14th. And he says, okay, do it, but you have to do it quick. There are not a lot of extra resources that we can commit to the occupation of Holland. And Göring steps up. You know, Göring is a, you know, he's kind of a pompous operatic character. And full of bravado, he says, well, the Luftwaffe can handle this alone. You know, Hitler looks back and he says, how? And Göring turns to Kurt Student, the head of his airborne arm, and says, can you do this through the use of an airborne operation? And Kurt Student looks at this and said, we can put something together. And so what happens is, for the invasion of Holland, one army is committed to this. So the German 18th Army, which is, I think it's mostly infantry divisions at this time, but it's eventually given the 9th Panzer Division, which is the last Panzer Division to be formed at this point. It's basically scraped together from remnants of the limited armored forces that the Austrian army had prior to the Anschluss, and then training units drawn from the Panzer training schools. And the plan is put together is, the 9th Panzer Division is going to push through southern Holland. It's going to attempt to bypass, breach, and then bypass the main defensive lines that run down the center of the Dutch nation. And it's going to attempt to drive up the Dutch road highway network. So across the main rivers and across the main bridges and get into the Vesting Holland or the water line from the south. That's the one weak point. If the Germans can control the bridges and drive up the Dutch highway network from the south, the main urban areas of Rotterdam, Den Haag, and Amsterdam can be accessible to attack. Problem is, those bridges have to be held. That's where the airborne unit comes in. Student says, all right, I've got a 4,500-man 7th Flieger Division made up of my elite paratroopers. I can drop those on the bridges, have them hold them until the tanks arrive. Student also has a 12,000-manned, what is called the Luftlande Division. These are not paratroopers. Instead, these are infantry that are flown in by transport aircraft and then who disperse and help to support the paratroopers. So the plan then unfolds to, well, I'm going to also use some of my paratroops to capture key Dutch airfields within the waterline. And these are all around the Dutch capital of The Hague. There are three airfields around Den Haag. There is also an airfield near Rotterdam. So paratroops are going to descend, capture those airfields, and then Luftlande troops are going to be flown in by transport aircraft to reinforce. And then, you know, just like a typical American story, you know, the soldiers in the forts are going to hold out till the cavalry arrives, the cavalry being the German armor.
And we have to remember that not a great deal of paratroop activity had been undertaken in this scale in the war at all so far.
No, they had never been used in effective combat, but certainly not on a large scale, certainly not for a strategic mission. But this is how Student Goering sell this to Hitler is, this is a surgical operation. This is going to be a surgical strike. We quick hold these key points. The panzers rush in. We capture the Dutch government. The campaign is over. They wanted to do in Holland what they did in Denmark. In Denmark, it was basically a six-hour campaign before German troops were marching into Copenhagen, marched up to the Royal Palace, and they got the King of Denmark to capitulate. What they wanted to do with Holland was similar with Denmark. Basically say, all right, we've moved in. We're here to protect you from the Allies. You can still manage all home rule, but Germany will now be responsible for foreign defense. That was the original plan with Holland. And so the air landing operations around The Hague with those airfields were designed where paratroops capture the airfields, Luftlande troops come in and land, then the Luftlande troops march into Den Haag. They walk up to the Royal Palace. They walk up to the Dutch government and say, we're here for your protection. In fact, it's kind of funny. There was actually the officers in charge of that operation were actually at the last minute given lessons in Dutch royal protocol and were given bouquets of flowers to present to Queen Wilhelmina and say, here, your majesty, we're here for your protection.
Now, there was a whole fleet of air transporters required to deliver this, but also they needed air cover as well, but that was a limited resource and required elsewhere.
So some fighter cover was designated for this, and in fact the fighter commander developed on paper what looked like a very intelligent rolling fighter cover schedule. Certain squadrons would take off, hover over territory for a while, and then head back to refuel. And then other squadrons were sent out to do that. The idea was that there was always going to be rolling fighter cover over the entire Dutch operational area throughout the campaign. One minor problem, though, and that is the Messerschmitt 109, its range. Now, if we talk about the Battle of Britain and the Bf 109's range, that rings a bell immediately. What was the time of action for an ME-109 over London during the Blitz?
Ten minutes.
But the thing is, it was the same over Holland because German fighters were coming from bases on the North Sea near Denmark. They were coming all around areas in the Ruhr, Dortmund, basically the same amount of distance that later German fighters would fly from their bases in France across the channel to England. This is the first campaign where the extreme short range of the ME-109 is going to be realized. And drop tanks hadn't been developed for the plane yet. So yeah. While on paper, the rolling fighter cover looks good, in practice, it does not happen.
Yeah.
So the chess pieces are set. How does it unfold?
Here's how it unfolds. So initially, on the early morning hours of May 10, 1940, German bombers start taking off. And they kind of skirt the Dutch border, and they fly out to the northwest, into the North Sea. Well, the Dutch pick this up, and the initial impression was, well, this sounds like a large-scale raid headed towards England, because the German bombers have their navigational lights on. They make no attempt to hide their movements. This is an intentional ruse de guerre on the Germans' part. Once out over the North Sea, the bombers begin to bank toward the west, and they fly down the English Channel parallel to Holland. And when the bombers reach a course parallel to their intended airfield targets, they all of a sudden turn back to the east and make an attack from the west. Great in theory, but the Dutch actually have an idea of what's going on, because all of the Dutch airfields go on alert when reports pick up of German bombers heading to England. The Dutch are suspicious because there's never been such a heavy raid that flies that close to their territory.
Yeah.
The other thing is, they've been getting reports from their GS3 section about massive buildups along their border for several days. And in the wee hours of that morning, Dutch border posts are beginning to hear lots of engines turning over across the German border. Lots of engines revving up, lots of motor vehicle movement. This is a bad omen. Something's up.
Yeah.
And then at 3:15 in the morning, about 45 minutes before the attacks on Dutch airfields are scheduled to take place, off the Dutch coast, the Luftwaffe begins laying aerial mines. And this is picked up by Dutch ships at sea, who actually open fire. This is the first shots of the Battle of Holland are 45 minutes before the attack is scheduled against German floatplanes and German bombers dropping aerial mines off of Dutch waterways. So the Dutch have several hours to 45 minutes of prior warning before the actual bombings take place. Now, there is confusion, there is fog of war, but most Dutch airfield commanders, you know, the commander of the Air Force, General Best, says at 1 o'clock in the morning, something's going on, put all fighter squadrons on alert, have all anti-aircraft batteries manned, and only a few local commanders stand down their forces after this. So when the German planes, the bombers, actually start coming across the Dutch coast prior to their attacks, all Dutch squadrons are in some state of readiness and all anti-aircraft batteries are manned.
Yeah.
So beginning at 3:55 in the morning, the Germans begin attacking Dutch airfields as their primary targets. The intention is wipe out Dutch fighter resistance, get air superiority over our targets, and knock out anti-aircraft defenses. So in many cases, the bombing begins, and in most cases, the Dutch squadrons fly up and are able to achieve a number of kills, particularly at the airfield at Valhaven, which is the airport for Rotterdam. Here, this is perhaps my favorite anecdote here. One of the pilots there, a guy by the name of Gerben Sondermann, this guy is actually the Fokker Company's test pilot, probably the most skilled pilot in the Dutch Air Force at this time. He gets his Fokker G1 airborne, and in a matter of minutes, he shoots down a Ju-52, he shoots down an ME-109 directly over downtown Rotterdam. He claims another 109, and then he comes across an HE-111 bomber on his way to land and shoots this one down. And this one happens to be the commander of KG-4, you know, the main bomber formation attacking the Dutch airfields. Yeah. So there's some remarkable successes in these early hours on the part of the Dutch. But here's the ultimate result. The Dutch lose quite a few aircraft in these raids and in air-to-air combat, but not all of them are destroyed. And these aircraft are actually vectored to smaller airfields that the Germans are not aware of. So the Dutch Air Force, while hit, stays intact for the remainder of the campaign because it disperses its remaining units in the wake of this first attack. Now, here's another problem. German bombers that attack the Dutch airfields are equipped with small caliber bombs. These are intended to hit anti-aircraft batteries or troop concentrations around the airfields. The Luftwaffe command did not want them using heavy ordnance against the airfields. Why? Because these airfields were going to have to be used to land German air landing troops. They needed to be captured intact. Well, because the majority of the bombers employed by the Luftwaffe in this are HE-111s, conventional bombing tactics, precision is not as good as if they had committed more Stukas or perhaps Ju-88s to this operation. Yeah. So most of the Dutch air defenses around the airfields are not knocked out. And let me give one more interesting little anecdote here. During the invasion of Norway, the Germans used air landing troops for the first time in the capture of Fornebu Airport at Oslo. This was a surprise. Ju-52's transports landed, troops piled out of them, captured the runways, captured the airfield. Well, there was a witness to all of this. Sitting on the tarmac at Fornebu on that day was a KLM airliner piloted by KLM Captain Evert van Dijk, who happened to be a member of GS3, the intelligence service. Yeah. He flew back to Amsterdam later that day with his passengers and went straight to the intelligence offices and reported everything he saw. And in the weeks prior to the German invasion, Best completely reorganized airfield defense strategy with the mind that if the Germans attack, they're going to pull something like this. They're going to try an air landing experiment, which means we need to put lots of machine gun posts around our airfields facing the airfield, not away from the airfield, and have pillboxes and other artillery things at the ready. So here's what happens. After the initial airfield attacks, the German air landing squadrons start flying in. And almost all of them at the airfields are met by heavy anti-aircraft fire and then by ground troop fire. And particularly around The Hague, at the airfields of Ypenburg and Aachenburg, these planes are met with ground fire immediately, and the Germans lose a ton of transports. They lose a lot of air landing troops in these things. And then at the third airfield around The Hague, at Falkenberg, ironically, that's the little town where my grandfather came from, their intelligence was really poor because this was a new airfield. The airfield had not been yet reinforced for the landing of heavy aircraft. Right, and what month are we dealing with here? We're dealing with May. Yeah. It's spring. Yeah. It's a wet month. The airfield is a muddy mess. The Ju-52s begin landing. And what happens? As soon as they touch down, they sink down to the top of their axles in mud. Yeah. Not one Ju-52 that lands at Falkenberg is able to take off again because they're all stuck in the mud.
Yeah.
This, the particularly around The Hague, this is an unmitigated disaster for the Germans. They underestimated the Dutch defenses and other, the only other basically reinforcements that are able to get in have to land on the beaches near the coast, and they sink into the sand. They can't take off again. Some land on highways and are able to take off again. But eventually by noon, reports are getting back to Luftflotte 2, Albert Kesselring's in charge, and he calls off all further reinforcement attempts around The Hague.
Yeah.
And the Dutch army, by late afternoon, recaptures every single one of those airfields. And the remaining German...
Yeah, they take a number of prisoners as well, don't they? Quite a significant number of prisoners.
Yep. About two-thirds of the Fallschirmjäger and Luftlande troops that land around The Hague are killed, and about 1,000 are captured, and the rest basically disappear into the woods. And they stay there until the Dutch surrender in hiding. The only place where the Germans had success was the capture of Valhaven Airfield outside of Rotterdam. The Fallschirmjäger that were assigned to capture the bridges along the highway up from the south, they succeed. And the Germans hold a very tenuous grasp on that highway and the bridges up to Rotterdam for the next several days. They are able to get reinforcements in some into Valhaven, but not very easy, because across the Maas River on the other side of Rotterdam, the Dutch set up artillery batteries, and they keep Valhaven under artillery bombardment for the remainder of the campaign.
And over the remaining days, the Fokker D-21s and the remaining pilots worked ferociously to defend the motherland. What happened next?
Yes, for the remainder days after the first day, after the initial shock of the invasion, the Dutch Air Force basically conducts a guerrilla campaign in the air against the Germans. It sends up small flights of fighters. And then also it employs its small force of bombers. And these are mostly biplane observation aircraft that they equip with bombs. And the Dutch turn to what they call hubobee tactics. And yes, this is something unique at the time. Hubobee is the abbreviation for the Dutch words huisjes, boompjes, biesjes, or houses, trees, and animals. In other words, these planes stay close to the deck. They fly just meters above the ground, weaving between buildings and stuff to avoid German fighter cover. And when they reach their targets, they quick pull up, they make their bombing attack, they drop back to the deck and get away. And while, you know, the material damage is not significant to the Germans in these attacks, the morale damage is. Because all throughout the campaign, it seems like the Dutch are always present in the sky. The Luftwaffe is saying, we have air superiority. We have air superiority. But the Germans are being tacked in little pinpricks by the air all throughout this campaign. And the Dutch do very well with this little guerrilla aerial campaign.
And it became more and more embarrassing for the Luftwaffe leadership. And eventually they gave in, didn't they?
That's eventually what it comes down to. So the Germans do hold the highway, the southern route, the back door into Fortress Holland. They hold that, but the Dutch hold the northern end of the bridge that leads into Rotterdam, and the Germans were not able to break the Dutch infantry hold on that. And for the days of the campaign, there's intense firefights across the Maas River in central Rotterdam, where the Germans try to dislodge the Dutch. They can't. The Dutch try to dislodge the Germans. They can't. It's a stalemate. And so finally, on the evening of May 13, the first German panzers arrive. And the German ground commander in Rotterdam decides, we're going to have to try an all-out ground attack across the bridge the next day. And we'll use tanks. We'll see how it goes. And he requests from the Luftwaffe, give me as many Ju-87s as you can. I need you to pinpoint specific Dutch defensive points on the northern side of the Maas in central Rotterdam. And the Luftwaffe comes back and says, we don't have Ju-87s to spare. We'll give you KG-54, which has HE-111s, and we'll do a conventional bombing of Dutch defensive positions over there. The German ground commander in Rotterdam says, no, I do not want a conventional bombing. I want a precision bombing, because if you just start dumping bombs over the northern end of Rotterdam, My tanks aren't going to be able to get through all the rubble. Rotterdam, at this time, is very much an old medieval city. Narrow streets. It's not a grid pattern. It's hard to get through. If there's a lot of destruction, the tanks are going to get bogged down into street-by-street fighting,
which,
by the way, they already did the day before in the city of Dordrecht, south of Holland.
Yeah.
As the German tanks were starting to work their way through the city of Dordrecht, the Dutch army rolled out its anti-tank guns and street-by-street fought the Germans to a halt in the middle of Dordrecht, destroying a number of panzers. Eventually, the commander of the 9th Panzer Division says, we can't do this, and bypasses Dordrecht in the countryside around it. There's just too many losses going on. And so the German concern is, we cannot get into that in Rotterdam. That'll just, you know, we don't have enough tanks, we don't have enough ground troops, we will lose. But here's the problem. Hitler is furious by this point at the delay. The airborne operation has been a complete failure, except for the capture of Walhaven and the bridges. Goering is taking the brunt of Hitler's wrath. And so Goering, the night of the 13th, turns to Kesselring and says, you end this immediately. And Kesselring goes, this is not a good idea. Goering says, no, bomb them into submission. Use conventional bombers. Obliterate part of Rotterdam. Use that to force the Dutch to surrender. And that's how the bombing of Rotterdam comes about. And unfortunately, this is not what the German ground commanders want. This is not what Kesselring wants. But Goering is at a complete loss of face at this point. Everything that he has put his hand on has fallen apart. And he's got to try to get back in favor with the Führer. So, and here's the tragic part of it. The Dutch agree to surrender negotiations on the early afternoon of the 14th. They get wind that a bombing attack is going to occur, and they decide, we don't have the air defenses to stop that. We don't want our cities destroyed. So surrender negotiations are underway when the first German bombers start showing up over Rotterdam. Now, the German ground commander had radioed back Luftflotte 2 and said, surrender negotiations are underway, abort the bombardment mission. So there's some dispute here. The Germans claim that, well, the bombers retracted their radial aerials in prior preparation to the attack, so they couldn't receive the abort order. Others say the abort order was never issued to the bombers because Goering wanted the attack to take place irregardless. He wanted to make a statement. Either way, the German bombers begin the air attack. German ground troops begin firing flares, which was an abort signal. But only, you know, only a handful of the German bombers saw those and did not release their bombs. The majority did. And the result was 1 square mile of Rotterdam is obliterated. You know, 85,000 are made homeless. There's about 1,000 casualties. It was an ugly affair. And the Dutch went back to the German negotiators after this. It's like, we had an agreement. What the heck are you doing? Yeah. And so they agree to surrender. And in the midst of these surrender negotiations, all of a sudden, there's the roar of more planes overhead. Goering decided to launch another terror bombing raid after the first. But fortunately, the German ground personnel are able to get through to these planes, and they all abort before another terror bombing of Rotterdam takes place. So that's what—that's how this ends. And in the midst of that bombardment, several German planes were dropping leaflets over Utrecht saying, Rotterdam is under bombardment. If you don't surrender, your city's next. So.
And that, in effect, brought the end of the campaign. From a historic perspective, Ryan, how is this air battle viewed?
You know, this is interesting, Peter. It really isn't. Did you, in your readings of aviation history of the Second World War, did you come across any of this?
Nothing.
No, and I think that's the average experience of the English reader is that in just about all general surveys of World War II or studies of the Western Front, the Battle of Holland gets a paragraph.
Yeah.
And yeah. Most of it's usually about the bombardment of Rotterdam and the ultimate surrender of the Dutch. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of strategic things that happened in this battle. So let's look at numbers for a second. How many German aircraft were lost? 455 German aircraft were lost or forced down in Dutch territory in those 5 days. If you include the number of German aircraft that limped back to Germany or were irreparable upon their return to Germany, that number goes to 540. Do you know what that number is?
No.
That is 54% of Luftflotte II's available aircraft on May 10.
Wow.
That's a loss rate of over 50%.
Yeah.
Of the aircraft that were committed over Dutch skies. It's massive.
It's quite interesting to think how stronger the Luftwaffe would have been with all those aircraft if the Dutch hadn't fought so fiercely.
Well, here's the thing, too. 284 of those aircraft were Ju-52 transport aircraft. That wiped out the majority of German aerial lift capacity on the Western Front. Now, I'm going to make something here, and I would, you know, your listeners can fight back later on, but I like to call the Battle of Holland the first chapter in the Battle of Britain, because what happened here was the Dutch Air Force eliminated German airborne potential in Sea Lion down the road. When we get to Sea Lion, the Luftwaffe is still reeling from its transport losses over Holland, not just in aircraft, but also in trained personnel. The airborne contingent that could be available for Sea Lion is minimal because of this. And here's the other thing. The Germans draw a very wrong conclusion from this battle, and this is particularly Goering. Goering looks at the bombardment of Rotterdam and says, a simple terror bombing can force a nation to knuckle under. And what tactic do the Germans eventually try to use on Britain?
Yeah.
When after the Goering switches his attacks away from airfields to the subjugation of London, he again tells Hitler, just like Rotterdam, we attack London, the British are going to knuckle under.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And the other thing is, the Germans hadn't fully learned the lesson of the short legs of their fighters.
And we talked earlier about the development of aircraft in Holland. It would have been interesting to see how that would have continued if this air campaign hadn't have stopped it. But that's it. It's a fascinating book. You can find it in the Ospreys Air Campaign series. But Ryan, where can we find you online?
You can find me online. I'm actually going to soon be launching my own Facebook author page. And I'm happy to interact with your listeners or any other aviation enthusiasts out there who would like to learn more about these things. I intend to keep working in the field of aviation and naval studies, so do look forward to subsequent books coming out from here. So, and I'm always happy to encourage new authors who want to get into this field as well.
And that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian for all of his support. I'd like to thank Elle at Osprey Publishing for connecting us with Ryan. And we'd also like to thank Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. You can find me and Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye, all. Thank you for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.